Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Phyllis Colander-Costanza, who is the head of UBS Philanthropy and CEO of the Optimus Foundation. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for making the time. I must say to the listeners that today we're going international. If I remember correctly, Phyllis, you are in New York right now.
Yes, I am.
Yes, and I'm currently actually in sunny Kent in the south of England. And we're trying a new methodology, again, just to have a disclaimer. So we're hoping that you're going to be able to listen to us with no problems. So as a way of introduction, Phyllis, I'm just going to share with the listeners a little bit about you. So Phyllis joined UBS in 2011 as the CEO of the UBS Optimus Foundation. And in 2018, she took on additional responsibility as the head of UBS Philanthropy. Since starting at UBS, she has reshaped the foundation strategy and introduced innovative financing vehicles like the first development impact bond in education. Prior to joining UBS, Phyllis was senior executive and board member of the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, CIF, worked in management consulting and the public sector in New York City, representative for New York State Governor Mario Cuomo. She continued to be a board member of the Power of Nutrition International and the International Center for Research on Women, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Phyllis holds a master's degree in public policy from Harvard University John F. Kennedy School of Government. What a wonderful career you have had so far, Phyllis. Anything I have missed or that we need to add?
You didn't include all the waitressing jobs and the bartending jobs I held through college.
I
That's
love it.
Okay.
That would be a long list for me as well. Yes, yes. Very good. So as it is our tradition, we tend to start with the first question, which is what is impact investing? But to avoid confusion, in this case, we will talk more about impactful philanthropy and social finance. Given that you mainly cover those areas, can you share, you know, the listeners, for those that may not actually know, what is philanthropy and social finance?
Great. Well, I'll actually share with you the spectrum from philanthropy all the way through to impact investing. And if we think of it in two core buckets, one of them is charitable giving and the other bucket is sustainable investing. And if we start on the charitable giving, there's really three elements to it. One is basic charity, and we call that kind of spray and pray. People just write checks and to organizations they don't necessarily know if they're having an impact or not, but you know, they feel good about it and it's a cause that they may care about because somebody in their family is related to the cause in some way. Then you've got strategic philanthropy, which is much more thoughtful, trying to achieve very specific goals with someone's philanthropy, with their giving. And so they strategize about how to give in a way that's most likely to achieve those goals. And then finally, in the charitable giving bucket, we've got social finance. And social finance is using finance in a way that achieves social outcomes. But the returns, and there may or may not be returns that come back, but those returns are concessional in nature. So they're not market rate returns. They're nominal returns based on the risk involved. And then if you think about the sustainable investing, this is kind of, I like to think of this as the gateway drug to sustainable investing. And we start with exclusion, taking out products that don't align with people's values, and ESG, which takes into consideration environmental, social, and governance issues. And then you have impact investing, which is delivering a market rate return, financial return, alongside a social outcome.
Wonderful. I thought that was a great summary and a great way to put it. And actually, I don't think we have anyone that had put it so clearly in terms of the spectrum. So thank you very much for that.
My pleasure.
If I may add, I'll remember to the listeners as well that I wrote an introduction to impact investing, which is in Forbes.com, which actually shows a video. And it shows most of the things that you talked about. But what I like that you added was that it doesn't show that how you go from charitable giving to a strategic philanthropy and then the social finance part, which I think adds another level so that people understand how that works and which is at the core of what you do as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Perfect. So I'm just going to share a little bit about your company and your organization. Again, just for background, I'm sure that everyone knows who UBS is, but I'll say a little bit more about UBS Philanthropy and Optimus Foundation. And I would definitely recommend, and I'll say this maybe a couple more times for people to go and visit your website, which is an excellent website and provides very good information very clearly. But you are the only foundation linked to a global wealth manager, which is staffed with philanthropy experts. And it says here that you have an approach that takes advantage of this unique network that you have, and you're taking the leading role in driving impactful philanthropy that delivers these breakthrough solutions for pressing social issues. But you also understand that solving these social problems requires collaborative initiatives that make the real impact at a large scale. And obviously, I can keep reading more from your website, but I thought I'd ask you, there's so much to cover in terms of what the Optimus Foundation does and what the UBS Philanthropy does. But can I just pass it on to you a little bit just to share maybe an overall summary and background about the foundation, how it came about, and where you are right now?
Sure. The foundation was actually started in, it was 1999 in Switzerland. And we had clients who wanted to give to actually research programs for children's health. And they didn't know how to do it on their own. And they wanted UBS as their wealth manager to help them structure how they give their philanthropy. And so at the time, UBS thought it could make sense to set up a foundation that was solely dedicated to helping our clients engage in philanthropy in a more meaningful way. And since then, we have grown substantially, and we are now not only located in Switzerland, Zurich, where we're headquartered, but we also have offices for Optimus Foundation in the U.S., in Germany, in the U.K., in Hong Kong, Singapore, and India. And what we're doing with Optimus is helping our clients execute on their philanthropy, which is unique from other financial institutions. If we think about our overall philanthropy offering, we offer three services. One is advice. So we help clients set up the right structure for their philanthropy. We'll advise them on their mission and vision. And we also offer insights. We take clients out to the field on experiences they really can't buy on their own. For instance, we took clients recently to Liberia, and we brought them, first we had to fly from Monrovia out to rural Liberia. And once we got there, we put them on the back of motorcycles and drove them on the motorcycles about 45 minutes into the bush to see how healthcare is delivered in some of the most remote places in the world. And those insight experiences are really unique, and it really engages clients in the act of giving and understanding what the needs are and how to implement programs to make them most effective. And then the final platform of what we offer in terms of philanthropy at UBS is that we help our clients actually execute on their philanthropy. And that's where UBS Optimus Foundation comes in. So we offer our clients, of course, donor advised funds, which are giving vehicles. But with donor advised funds, they don't necessarily come with expert advice on which programs are most impactful, what sorts of monitoring and evaluation systems should they implement in order to have a really good sense of whether or not a program is working. And at Optimus Foundation, we help our clients do all of that. We are a service just for our clients. And the way it works is clients who are interested in a particular issue will work with us. And we have about 175 programs right now on our platform. And we're trying to encourage our clients to engage in collective philanthropy, whereby they're coming together to solve problems jointly. So they can do this through the existing portfolios, or we can work with our clients on a specific tailored opportunity. And we always try to drive them towards the most impactful program. So for instance, we had a client come to us who was interested in a program that was flying American and European doctors to Africa and Asia to perform surgical procedures. And there's no doubt that they're delivering a desperately needed service when you think about a billion people don't have any access to healthcare. It's increasing the access, certainly. However, if we think about ways that we can make that more sustainable, we actually want the organization to be training local physicians to provide this. We want to make sure that there's post-op checkups for the patients to reduce post-op infection rates. And so we really encourage this client to think more about how to make this the program that he was really interested in supporting more impactful. And that led to discussions. It took 2 years to come up with a solution, which was we want to improve the quality of surgical care in some of the most underserved populations. And so we're promoting a whole safe surgery initiative because 17 million people die every single year for lack of access to surgery. And so we're promoting an initiative that's looking at a number of opportunities to improve the quality of healthcare and particularly surgical care in places in Africa and also in Southeast Asia. So that's an example of how we might work with a client on a tailored opportunity.
Fascinating. And then you mentioned before, how many programs are you running right now?
Right now, we've got actually precisely 176 programs under management, and those are all over the world. We're in more than 20 countries, I believe, right now.
Okay. People, again, can see some of the examples of the program on the website, but I did pick up in a couple which you had there around slavery, so the education, you mentioned health, then the orphanages, and then there's one which is about, I remember an article that you wrote on LinkedIn, which is what is one girl's worth, I think. So you have several themes in the way that you actually allocate all the programs, or?
Yes, well, we focus in three areas. And the reason we've chosen specific areas to focus on is because we really want to offer clients expertise. And we can't do that if we are too broad. Mm-hmm. And the areas that we're focusing on are education, healthcare, and child protection.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason these three areas is because each of them are essential for children to thrive and be productive and live a fulfilling life. If a child gets a great education but has no access to healthcare, you know, they can't survive. And within each of these areas, we have very specific strategies. So within healthcare, for instance, we're focused on areas such as safe surgery, frontline healthcare, and pediatric cancer. And we're looking at things that are underfunded and where the problems are going up. For instance, pediatric cancer. In the U.S., death rates for children are going down substantially, whereas in Africa, they're going up. So children are dying in greater numbers from cancer. So that's an area, for instance, that we're focusing on. And within child protection, we're focused, as you mentioned, on anti-trafficking programs and also on deinstitutionalization. So getting children out of orphanages and into families. We know that 80% of children in orphanages right now are actually not orphans at all. They have parents, but parents are forced to put their children in alternatives to their home because they can't afford to give them the life that they deserve. They can't afford to feed them. They can't afford to educate them, and they can't afford to protect them. And they think that orphanages will be a better alternative because sometimes unscrupulous orphanage owners will tell them that. And so we're trying to provide support to families so that they can take care of their children and get them out of the orphanages, which we all know are bad for children. I mean, look, in Europe, in the UK, where you are right now, and in the United States, we don't have orphanages anymore because they're bad for children. And we're also looking at trying to prevent things like voluntourism. Now, have you seen, I'm sure, in the UK, the rise of these vacation holidays where you spend a week, for instance, in an orphanage? And I mean, think about this. You know, you might go to a place like Ghana, spend a week in an orphanage with kids, and there's no vetting process. They let anybody go and do this voluntourism, and it makes us feel better that we're going to a place. But would we ever allow people from another country to come in and take care of our children in an orphanage setting? It's absurd that this is permitted. And for children in an orphanage, every week there's a new rotation of people coming through and they experience loss over and over again. And I always think about this story. This really came to light with my kids because they grew up in Switzerland where I work for UBS. And at their school, which was a great school, they did these service trips. My daughter went to Sri Lanka and she and 25 of her classmates were ready to save the world and they were going to go volunteer in an orphanage. And when she came back, I asked her how it was. And of course, she said it was an incredible experience. And, you know, they spent so much time with the kids, playing with them, reading with them, talking with them. And she said, but it was really sad. When she left, they got on a bus that was going to take them to the airport. And there was one girl who grabbed onto my daughter's leg and was crying, begging her not to leave. And, you know, you can imagine these kids experiencing this loss over and over again, somebody they become close with who's leaving. And they know these people, you know, they're never going to come back again. And these types of trips do unbelievable harm to kids. So we're also working to try to limit and prevent these types of trips, which actually I believe they've now made illegal in Australia.
I see.
Yeah, and then finally, education.
Yes.
On education, we're focused on improving the quality of education, focused on displaced children whose education have stalled because they're now refugees in a country that might not speak the language, and for many other reasons. We're also focused on improving the quality of skills so people can have social mobility. And the third area is education technology to improve the way we can teach children so they learn better.
Fantastic. I was going to come to that point about education, but one thing I was going to mention about, picked up from some of your messages that you share, is that the importance of growing up in a family. That kind of stuck in my mind, to have that support and that safe place to develop is key, right? That people don't sometimes appreciate that we have.
Exactly.
Yeah. And about education, I was going to highlight that you had the world's first development impact bond for education. And I initially saw a bit of the model of how you structure it to be able to provide the funding, but at the same time work with other organizations and be able to track the results that you are obtaining. And I thought I'd highlight, because you have the 2018 annual report. I'm not sure if it is out there just yet, but your colleague Simone shared with me. And I picked up on page 24, in case we put the link with the podcast for people to read it. There's a really good picture that shows how your whole model works, right? So is there anything that you can share maybe on this call with the listeners so that they understand how you give the funding, how you track it, why is it so effective, and perhaps about
Absolutely.
The bond itself as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So the social finance, as I mentioned earlier, is a way to bring in hopefully more money from the private sector and better money focused on outcomes. And we're really looking at addressing primarily the sustainable development goals. And so we launched the first development impact bond really as an experiment. We didn't know if it was going to work. We were following the model set by social impact bonds. They started in the UK to reduce recidivism rates in prisons. And they've since flourished. Now they're in dozens of countries around the world, and there's more than 100 of them right now. And so we wanted to take that model and apply it to the development sector. We were approached by Educate Girls to do this, and we thought it was a really exciting opportunity and actually a great one for a financial institution to play. So we gave money, funding, to Educate Girls with two really clear goals in mind. One goal was to get 72% of girls in a particular area into school who weren't in school for a number of reasons, but primarily because the parents wanted them at home. They didn't see the value in sending their girls to school. And the second goal was to improve learning outcomes by 75% better than the control group. So those two outcomes were set at the beginning. We then found an outcome funder, which was Children's Investment Fund Foundation, linked to the hedge fund TCI, and they would pay back UBS, who was Optimist Foundation, who was the investor, if and only if Educate Girls delivered on those outcomes. So at the end, this ran for 3 years, and at the end, they exceeded both targets. So we got the full payback. Educate Girls also got a bonus to incentivize their staff as well. So what's the purpose of this? Purpose of these bonds is, from our perspective, is to bring in people who otherwise wouldn't be comfortable funding internationally. If we look at the U.S., 96% of all charitable giving stays in the U.S., and people don't give internationally for a lot of reasons, but one of them is they're not sure of the impact. They don't trust it. We've also seen from our clients, 90% of our large clients are giving philanthropically, yet fewer than 20% of them are satisfied with their impact. So we wanted to try to attract those clients who we thought had a lot more potential to give a lot more if the impact was transparent for them. And this vehicle makes it completely transparent. And it also gives the power to the nonprofit organization, that organization on the ground implementing the program, to do whatever it takes to achieve the outcome. So we're not incentivizing their activities. You know, if you look at traditional contracts to nonprofits, it's based on activity. So, you know, we'll give you X amount of money if you train this many teachers. We'll give you X amount if you buy this many computers. We'll give you this amount for the books. When really what we all want to achieve is make sure that kids are learning, because unless they learn something from those books, from those teachers, from those computers, their life outcomes will never be better. They're not going to find a job. And so what we've done in this is said to Educate Girls or other organizations, hey, you know what? We're not going to incentivize you based on those activities. You've got to achieve these outcomes, and you do it in whatever way you think is most efficient. And so I think that's the beauty of these types of structures, is we can try to encourage more money from the private sector, which is new money, which we desperately need to achieve the sustainable development goals.
Yes, excellent. So if I just briefly try to summarize in terms of the players or stakeholders of that model, basically is UBS as the investor, Educate Girls in this case, like the implementation partner, right? And then you have the girls and the families, which are the beneficiaries. And then the Children's Investment Foundation, which is the kind of the outcome payer, right?
Exactly. Actually, just to further complicate something that's already very complicated, we also had Instiglia, which served as the intermediary. They really coordinated everything. Mm-hmm. And we had, because this first one, it was complicated. It took about 18 months to structure. It cost a lot of money to structure. And so we needed somebody to help coordinate that. And then we had ID Insights, who ran the randomized control trial, which was important to validate the outcomes. And since that first one, which was expensive, it was time consuming, we've since reduced the time and the cost substantially. We're now on our third one, and the costs have come down dramatically to just a fraction of what it was. And also the time to develop it has come down, because we're now starting to standardize the process and the contracts, et cetera.
Of course, yes. And I know that this is not about the actual funds sometimes as much as the outcome and the effect that it has on people's lives. But just to give some context, you know, what can you remind us, what was the size of this bond? And then how much, you know, today are you investing?
So this first one was $300,000. And it reached, I think it was up to 7,000 children for that.
Yes.
And am I right on the number, Chris?
Yes, I'm reading here. 7,000 children, 166 schools and 140 villages.
Excellent. And however, the ones we've done since now are closer to $11 million. And now we probably won't do any of them for less than probably $20-25 million. So we're really looking to make these substantially larger so that we can start to scale some of these solutions again, so that we achieve much bigger outcomes for a lot more children.
Yes, as you mentioned as well, there are many organizations now doing education bonds, and they are, in some of the cases, pretty sizable, maybe the hundreds of millions, right?
I don't think for development impact bonds they've achieved that level of scale yet. I think they're still relatively small, but hopefully, and we're, I think, working with a number of governments right now to see if we might be able to put together with bilateral donors, a large outcome fund in the hundreds of millions, but we haven't, and I don't think anybody has achieved that level of scale yet.
Okay.
That's our goal, though.
Okay. I think I had a note about one of the bonds I wanted to mention, but I can't find it right now, but if I remember, I'll mention it later on.
Okay.
And then if we talk about kind of your clients and your partners, you mentioned some really good insights in terms of the percentages of how many people invest in the U.S. versus how much they don't trust and how much they give versus how much they're satisfied. Can you give us a bit more information about kind of your clients? What is the, I know that it's not one profile and it is individuals actually giving their own wealth away. But can you share a little bit of an example so that if there is a wealthy individual out there that would like to come and engage with you, that they can relate to?
Absolutely. So the exciting part is that we're seeing an increase globally in people who want to make a difference while they're still alive, particularly in Asia. Our largest Optimus office is, in fact, in Hong Kong, where we have a lot of substantial donors, and they really want to give back into mainland China. I think 99% of all of our clients' donations from Hong Kong go into China, whereas our clients in Europe tend to want to give, not surprisingly, in Africa primarily, also some in Southeast Asia. While we know statistically most Americans start charity at home here in the U.S., but for many, it doesn't end here at home. For many, it continues outside. Yesterday, I met with a client who's doing incredible work, again, around safe surgery, and he is funding hospitals in sub-Saharan Africa to improve the quality of training to ensure, because there's such a shortage of physicians, and one of the leading causes of death among maternal and newborn death is lack of access to C-sections. And so he is training clinicians who may not be physicians to perform what is a pretty basic procedure of a C-section. And this has a huge impact on reducing mortality rates for mothers and for newborns. And I have clients who are just incredibly inspirational. I have one client in the U.S. who wanted and has made a substantial amount of money only because he feels it's his obligation to improve the lives of the most vulnerable children, which are children who are trafficked. And he is going to sell his business for a substantial amount of money and has decided that he only needs a small portion to live on, less than $100,000 a year. And this person will have substantially more, hundreds of millions. Yes. And he wants to give all of his money away to improve the lives of children while he's still alive. And he also believes his children don't need that money either. They're very fortunate and they can also live on substantially less than him. And so he's going to give it all away. And people like that are incredibly inspiring to me.
Yes, yes. And as we know, some of the richest people in the world are basically giving most of their wealth away, a bit of, you know, just to highlight that it's more than a trend, really, right? So it's nothing new, but it's just the scale of it is quite something these days.
Yeah, it's really impressive. And, you know, Bill Gates really helped to start this trend through the Giving Pledge. And so yes, people have committed to give away half of their net worth in their lifetime, but now they need help to do it.
Yes, yes. So foundations have developed as well a lot in terms of their best practices, right? So they're actually sharing best practices as well among each other. And I went to an event here in London run by the Asian Banker, which was called Wealth and Society. I was invited at the end of last year, and they were highlighting the rise of foundations, obviously of wealth in China, and setting up a foundation there, but also that American foundations are coming across to share with them how they do things. So there's kind of cross-pollination about how to best operate, which is, you know, very good.
Absolutely. We're seeing a lot more sharing amongst foundations, amongst families, and we're trying to bring families together. We have something called the Global Philanthropist Community, which connects our largest clients with each other around the globe to people they would never have otherwise the opportunity to meet, who are interested in the same things, and they can share the lessons from each other. And we do that as well. That's why we set up the Educate Girls DIB .org website, because we wanted to share the lessons learned, good and bad, of the Educate Girls DIB, because we know that these development impact bonds and structures like this are not the thing. These are not the end game, but the thing to the thing. You know, we can each take something and learn something from this to create the next best iteration of it. And I hope we continue iterating it and improving on it.
Great. What was that? Normally I ask about kind of identifying and measuring impact, right? So obviously, because you have so many programs, you know, I think we kind of go through all of them. Well, I want to believe that given the example that we gave with education, for example, and some of the others, I want to believe that people understand a little bit more about how Optimus Foundation works. But is there anything else that we can share perhaps around identifying and measuring impact? I know that you have that saying, driving transformation, better giving, better results. But is there anything in particular that people have to look at in terms of factors and what to measure and how to measure?
Well, there's two key aspects to identifying a good program. One is the due diligence, and one is the ongoing monitoring and evaluation. And on the due diligence, it is very similar to how one would evaluate a company. We're looking at the management of the organization. We're looking at the context in which they're operating. We're looking at the program itself. Is it actually impactful? Is third-party data solid to demonstrate that this actually works? And then finally, we're looking at the financials. So that's on the due diligence side. And then on the ongoing monitoring evaluation side, not everything requires a randomized controlled trial. That's the gold standard. And, you know, it's not without its costs. It's very expensive. And so what is the minimum amount of information that's required to assess whether or not something's working? And that's important. Oftentimes, we have no idea whether or not a program is working. One example, which is really startling for me, is a U.S. example. This isn't philanthropy. This is actually government money. But I think we can draw some parallels to philanthropy. But government money in the U.S., roughly, we spend about $800 billion a year from local, state, and federal money. And of that $800 billion, we have knowledge of impact of less than 1% of that. And that's pretty startling. You know, this is our money. This is taxpayer money. And I think people would feel the same about their philanthropic money. It's unconscionable to think that we're throwing money away, especially when it's intended for people who need it so badly. So it's important to find out whether or not something's working, but to do it in a really reasonable way, not one that's overly onerous, not one that puts more burden on the beneficiary, so it's not even worth it for them to accept the funding. So we have to be really thoughtful, and I think we've got a lot of work to improve that.
Okay. And that's where I think that the partnering, the collaborations with organizations comes into play, right? Which becomes very helpful so that the beneficiaries are not the ones who are being overwhelmed with KPIs and other things.
Exactly. Yeah.
And just now, if we move into like looking into the future, what is the vision and the strategy of UBS Philanthropy and Optimus Foundation? You mentioned that you were already in several countries, right? It's about growing your presence, growing your client base from UBS or new clients, or obviously growing your programs, doubling the programs, number of programs.
So our vision is not necessarily about physical presence anymore. We're now, by middle of next year, we'll be in our largest markets. Our vision, though, is to bring more money and better money to solve some of the critical social challenges and doing it at scale and in a sustainable way. So right now, for instance, we're granting about $80 million US per year. There's no reason that shouldn't be $800 million. And we can get there. You know, if you think about all financial institutions, just look at UBS, we've got approximately $2.5 trillion of assets under management. If clients dedicated only 0.5% of that, that would be more than $12 billion each year. And that could make a real dent in solving some of these really important issues. So that is our vision.
Yes.
Yeah.
Half a percent. So I hope that doing today's interview adds a little bit in terms of just generating the awareness. What I have found after I learned about UBS Philanthropy Services and Optimus Foundation is that a lot of people don't know about it. So hopefully we'll share and generate more awareness, at least about your services and what you do, which ideally is going to help move some of that money as well, or new.
That's great. And not just for UBS. I mean, I think financial institutions are in a really unique position, and they could provide so much support to clients, to wealthy clients in particular, who have a lot of money that they want to put to work for social good. And so I would really hope that a lot more financial institutions are helping clients, not just giving them advice, but helping them to actually execute on the plan.
Great. And I must also self-disclaim here that I'm a big fan of UBS, so I follow quite a lot of the things that you do, and I see that you have many initiatives, you know, taking place all the time. You know, you have your CIO, Mark Hafele, right?
Yeah, and Mark is incredibly committed to sustainable investing and is doing a lot to drive that at UBS, and has moved now almost $5 billion of assets into sustainable investing programs, products.
Yeah, so I would also recommend people to follow him, because he's constantly sharing information, white papers, investment strategies, ideas, and much more. And I also want to finish the conversation without talking about your recently launched Together Bands, which is this initiative, this movement, actually to create more awareness about SDGs. Is there anything that we can share today?
Yeah, so this is really exciting and fun, frankly. It's a partnership with UBS and an organization called Bottle Top, which is a British social enterprise and foundation that's working with artisans through design and creation of sustainable luxury goods. And they also raise money for health education projects, primarily in Africa. We're partnering with them to create bands bracelets, basically, that are sustainably produced. And there's 17 of them, each a different color, representing a different sustainable development goal. And we're trying to build a global community of more than a billion active citizens who are going to come together to achieve these goals, the goals through fashion and creative culture. And these bands are actually, as I mentioned, produced in a sustainable manner in Nepal, primarily providing livelihoods to women. And we have ambassadors, an iconic ambassador, who's going to lead a group of global influencers along with an expert for each of the SDGs. And we'll have videos of them explaining about the SDGs, how people can get involved. And the bands also are meant to be shared. So when you buy one, you get two. And hopefully you'll share that band with somebody and post it online so we can bring more people into this community. And to get more information, go to togetherband.org and order your band today. That's a shameless promotion.
Perfect. And it gives the chance for people too that don't know to learn more about the different goals and to see which one is the one that they prefer or would like to support the most, which is great. We were talking about SDGs and we were talking about kind of scaling. So I'm not going to go too much more into that. But the point here, what I picked up from what you said is we need to just create more awareness. We need to explain to people what is possible, show the impact that it's having so that we can get more funding. Is that a fair summary?
Exactly. I mean, I think it's simple. More awareness, more money, and more impact. So it's not just, as we say in the healthcare space, it's not just about more money for health, but it's more health for the money. And we want that for each of the SDGs. Let's make sure that whatever we're doing to achieve them is truly impactful.
Brilliant. And if there's one thing that you need help with, perhaps, you know, one of the listeners is out there and could bring it home for you, is there anything that you would like to ask?
I'd like to ask the listeners is how can we reduce volunteerism so that we prevent some of this harm that I talked about coming to children? Any ideas you have on that, raising awareness about the harmful effects of volunteerism, would be greatly appreciated.
Perfect. Thank you. And I don't want to finish without asking you a little bit about you, if that's okay?
Okay.
So basically, the main question is, how did you evolve to be doing what you're doing from all those jobs, waitressing and all the different roles that you have and now driving this great initiative with UBS?
Yes, from humble employment beginning, my very first job was serving ice cream at Carvel's in upstate New York. So from there, it's a long story to how I got here. But basically, I was interested in public service my entire life. And I worked for New York State Governor Mario Cuomo. And after that, got a master's in public policy because I wanted to pursue a career in that. And quite fortunately, some friends of mine from graduate school asked me to sit on their board. They were setting up at the time a family foundation, which turned into the Children's Investment Fund Foundation, which is one of the largest foundations focused on children's issues globally. And sitting on the board was so fascinating for me, and I loved the work. So I started working for them full time, and I did that for many years. And that's when I discovered what I ought to be doing in life. And then I was recruited to come to UBS about 8 years ago to run their foundation. And that role has since evolved as well. And that's how I got here, from scooping ice cream to Carvel's in a very abridged version.
Fantastic. And through your career, you must have met so many people, so many leaders. So what makes a good leader?
I think really important quality of leadership is letting your people shine. And that's what I try to do with my team and really giving them the space and the flexibility to do what they do best. And I always hire people who are a hell of a lot smarter than I am. And so they can figure it out. And I think that that's one of the most important qualities of leadership is to enable your team to shine.
Yeah. And what advice would you give to someone that wants to give more and better? As we're coming up to the end of the podcast, maybe as an advice to somebody that wants to come to help you or to help UBS Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Great. Well, you know, I get a lot of requests from people asking, how should they focus their career? They ultimately want to get into this type of work. And I think one of the most important qualifications is finance, frankly, because It's so much of what we're trying to do is make money work effectively, making it go as far as possible. And we've done that so well in the private sector. We understand how to use debt. We've created all sorts of interesting and innovative financing mechanisms to enable us to fund things that otherwise wouldn't be funded. And we need more of that in the social sector, too. So I always encourage people to study finance. It will come in handy in ways that you can never imagine.
I agree. Well, being myself a person with a finance background, I do think that is a very good skill. But I appreciate how it becomes so much more relevant doing what you do and what we're trying to do in terms of achieving scale and more impact. So thank you. If people want to get in touch with you or the foundation and UBS Philanthropy, what is the best way to do it?
Best way to get in touch is through LinkedIn.
Perfect.
You can reach me at Phyllis Curlander-Costanza.
Brilliant. And then if there is one last call to action for listeners, is there anything else you want to ask?
Call to action, something that you can do right now is get a together band and share it with someone.
There you go. That's your opportunity to shine, people. So get your band, together band, hashtag together band, and share with somebody so that we can better have more awareness about SDGs. So thank you so much, Phyllis. I really appreciate your time, your insight, all the things that you said today. And we're very grateful to you and to UBS.
Thanks so much. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Perfect. That was it for today. Thank you so much for listening to Impact Leaders. And until the next one. And please remember to check the website of our sponsors for upcoming events. Until next one.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.